This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Hi, I'm Jamie Bussin. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss spring drinking in moderation with mixologist Graham Reed. We'll find out how cannabis can be used in spiritual practice with author Will Johnson. We'll learn how to boost your vagus nerve function with author Dr. Nawaz Habib. And lastly, we'll discover the relationship between menopause and alcohol with counselor and coach Sophie Solmini. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. A research group in Japan has discovered that writing down one's reaction to a negative incident on a piece of paper and then shredding it or throwing it away reduces feelings of anger. Participants in the study were asked to write a brief opinion about important social problems, such as whether smoking in public should be outlawed. The participants were told that a doctoral student would be evaluating their writing. However, the doctoral students doing the evaluation were plants. Regardless of what the participants wrote, the evaluators scored them low on intelligence, interest, friendliness, logic, and rationality. To really drive home the point, the doctoral students also wrote some insulting comments like, "I can't believe an educated person would think like this. I hope this person learns something while they're at university." After handing out these negative comments, the researchers asked the participants to write their thoughts on the feedback, focusing on what triggered their emotions. One group of participants was told to either dispose of the paper they wrote on in trash can or keep it on file in their desk. A second group was told to destroy the document in a shredder or put it in a plastic box. The students were then asked to rate their anger after the insult and after either disposing or keeping the paper. As expected, all the participants reported a higher level of anger after receiving the insulting comments. However, the anger levels of the individuals who discarded the paper in the trash can or shredded it returned to their initial state after disposing of the paper. Meanwhile, the participants who held on to a hard copy of the insult experienced only a small decrease in their overall anger. Along with its practical benefits, the discovery may shed light on the origins of the Japanese cultural tradition known as Hakita Shisara. Hakidashi refers to purging or spitting out of something, and Sara refers to a dish or a plate. At the Hiyoshi Shrine in Kyushu, Aichi Prefecture, just outside of Nagoya, Hakita Shisara is an annual festival where people smash small discs representing the things that make them feel angry. These findings may explain the feeling of relief that participants report after leaving the festival. I'll be joined by Graham Reed in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. Graham Reed is a mixologist and owner of Reed's Distillery. Today, we're going to do something completely different at The Tonic. We're going to talk about alcohol and gin in particular and all sorts of drinks. Welcome to the show. How are you?
Hey, well, thank you very much for having me, and pretty good. It's been pretty exciting kind of thinking about coming onto this show, because The Tonic, it's going, okay, how do you talk about gin and the history of gin as well? So
exactly, because interestingly, the history of gin is actually tied to health and wellness, isn't it?
You know what? A lot of alcohols have been, but gin has a, well, both a history of kind of health and wellness, but as well kind of a necessity where people needed it to be, whether it be for the Navy or things like that. So there was a lot of kind of history to it. And it's what makes it such an interesting spirit to me as well.
Yeah, I mean, I've delved a little bit into it. So for example, in Italy with Amaros, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. Or you know, digestives, right? Yeah. Like literally, when you think about digestive, people would drink these bitter concoctions to help get their juices going, to help mm-hmm. digest their food. It was as important as the post-meal walk would be to have a little bit of, you know, a little bit of something to help get everything going.
Exactly. And it's whether it be Amaros or all the way through different liqueurs. A lot of times with the, you know, the noble families would have specific liqueurs that they would have for themselves. And that's what's led to a variety of different liqueurs still around to this day.
Yeah. Correct. All right. But let's focus on gin
for sure.
and tonic mm-hmm. because gin yeah. is right in your wheelhouse. Yeah. So, you know, the classic drink is a gin and tonic. And,
yep.
and you know, I often joke, you know, the name of this show, the name of my magazine is Tonic, which mm-hmm. has sort of multiple meanings. And it's apropos in this context. So, let's start at sort of at the beginning there. What is tonic water?
Yeah, so tonic water has evolved. I like to always yeah. clarify that because I think people often think of tonic as being kind of what we have today.
Right.
But it wasn't always that way. Tonic was originally really seen as a method of kind of helping fight certain ailments. It really did start off really in Peru is where the origin story is. It was a that as kind of the British Navy went throughout South America, they witnessed this kind of reliance on this this bark that the locals would be chewing on to help fight a fever. And so it didn't take them long to kind of, okay, we could extract this. They would grind it down into a powder. And then from there, they would add this to water, and they would use this to help fight ailments like fever and very quickly help fight malaria. So that's where kind of tonic water started as a remedy and a cure for malaria. I do have to clarify, tonic water no longer fights malaria. Malaria right. outsmarted tonic water, but that's kind of where it started off. But it quickly spread globally because of the British Navy.
Right. I was going to say the British Empire. When I think of tonic, mm-hmm. I think of India, right? Because yeah. The British Navy obviously had set up colonies in India. Mm-hmm. And they were fighting malaria, and I understood it was made with quinine. Is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. So the bark of the cinchona tree has quinine in it, and that would be what they were grinding down into that powder. And then they would mix that with water, a little bit of sugar. You can see how it started to become tonic water that we now know today, but it was still very rudimentary. It wasn't carbonated. It was pretty rough, right? It was medicine,
right.
Effectively. So.
And if you've had artisanal tonics, right, not mm-hmm. not the big brands,
yeah.
there is that very sort of, I guess, the forward flavor is bitter,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and it does taste medicinal,
mm-hmm.
and some of them use trace amounts of quinine still, right?
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Yeah, there's only really a few that don't, actually, of the more premium tonic waters. Most do,
right.
And then there's some that don't due to the fact that there is some health implications of using that as well.
So. Correct. All right, and so that's tonic, but gin sort of has a health origin as well too, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like to speak to kind of the origins of gin was Genever, and that was seen as, again, a digestif and had medicinal properties. And so gin itself kind of played two roles, especially with the British Navy. It played the role of being deemed, medical, and it helped people fight ailments, but it as well was seen as a bit of a reward for those who enlisted in the Navy. So it was a ration that they would be given, and that's where kind of the two started to meet, was really with the rations that the sailors were being given. Yeah.
Okay, how is gin made?
Yeah, so gin itself, there's a couple different ways to go about it, but in order to make gin, you first need to start with a base alcohol.
Right.
And so, that can come from a whole host of base ingredients. That could be grains, right? So you could do your barley, your rye, your wheat, could be potatoes, could be anything with a starch or sugar is really what you're needing.
Okay.
If it is a starch, it needs to be kind of converted into those fermentable sugars. Then that's going to be distilled after fermentation, and you end up with this base alcohol that gets distilled all the way up to 96%, which is, while strong, it is also meaning that there's very little congeners or off flavors present in that base alcohol. That's what's then going to be kind of redistilled one last time with our kind of collection of botanicals. So it depends on the gin. Typically, you won't find gins go less than four botanicals, orris root, angelica, juniper being the primary,
right,
and coriander being, those are your four primary ones you're going to find in, I would say, 90% of gins out there. But okay, then you can go and add as many as you'd like.
Okay, so I always understood the name gin came from Ginever, which yes, which is a is it a Nordic pronunciation of juniper? Is that right?
Correct. Yeah. So the terminology that the Dutch would use to describe their homemade alcohol, which was Jenever, is the yeah, more correct pronunciation.
Yeah.
But here in North America, Ginever is become the common pronunciation. And it was something that the Dutch would make. They would pass these recipes down generation to generation, and they were kind of really kind of more within their local community. Not until about the 30 Years' War when the Dutch introduced to the British this Genever alcohol, and that's where it kind of riffs into gin that we know today. Because while the British took this Genever juniper forward, sweetened, sometimes aged alcohol, and they started to add in other ingredients because the spice trade was increasing at the time. They
yep,
had access to coriander. They had access to all these different things. And they also probably struggled with the pronunciation of Jenever or Jenever. So
yeah,
they just shortened it down to gin. And that's where gin became its own alcohol. So Jenever is still an alcohol that you can buy today, but gin has kind of gone off on its own path.
Yeah. Okay, so you make gin, correct?
That is correct, yes.
Is there such a thing as organic gin or yeah, or is that just a pipe dream?
No, I mean, your base ingredients, right? At the end of the day, your base ingredients are going to be organic if you, you know, if you are making an organic gin. You know, it is important to understand in the distillation process, you are distilling that product up to 96%
right,
alcohol. The remaining 4% is water. Not a lot of proteins come through. For example, on like a gluten-free front, our base is wheat, and we're able to, it is gluten-free because it goes all the way up to 96%. Any of those proteins are not brought through. So,
okay,
it, you know, there's things like that that it's important to understand when you're dealing with a base alcohol. If you're producing a whiskey or something like that, where you're only going up to about 70%, that's where you're going to get a lot more congeners, a lot more kind of things coming through during the distillation. So you want to be a little bit more aware of that.
Okay. So theoretically, we're getting into the nice weather. We're not really there yet, but
yeah,
I think of gin as sort of like a spring or summer drink. Is that what you're finding, that a lot of people sort of perceive gin as sort of a fair weather drink?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting how people, you know, the kind of patterns and the trends. Of course, you see socializing in general is an area where people generally will enjoy gin and enjoy drinking in general. And so holiday season, of course, you see a
yeah,
spike there. But coming into the summer months, it really is how you position yourself. And we do have a gin and tonic product that we're very proud of because it's literally just gin and tonic. There's
right,
nothing, there's no artificial flavoring, there's no preservatives.
Right.
It's just literally, we said, how come we can't just make this a standard thing?
Right.
And so that one we've found during the summer months, it's overwhelmed in us in terms of its popularity, which is great. It's meant we have to try and keep pace and make sure we can keep it on the LCBO shelves. But yeah, summer months, it's kind of the go-to time for people to enjoy the outdoors. And okay, with that, a little bit of gin and tonics as well.
So another famous gin drink is the Gimlet, right?
Yeah, the Gimlet is I would say right up there with one of the most famous gin drinks. Yeah.
Okay, and you're going to make one for us today?
I would love to make one for
you. All right, them. Well, yeah, let's get to it.
Yeah, so I'm going to be opening up the gin here right now
yeah,
first. So we've got our signature gin. Actually, just won Best Gin in Canada last year at the World Gin Awards. So very proud about that. There
oh,
we go.
Nice.
I know, right? So then with this cocktail here, it's going to be kind of a bedrock style cocktail. And that's what I love about any cocktail that has really your simple syrup, which is your kind of
yep,
your sweetening base, your lime juice, which is going to be your sour or your bitter, and then, of course, your spirit. So every cocktail you make is a balance of those three things, and this really kind of exemplifies that. So what I'm going to do first is I've got my shaker here,
yep,
and I'm going to be adding in, I always try and start with my lower, I call them lower cost ingredients, just in case you make a mistake. Start off with your syrups and your juices because, you know, your premium gin, you want to kind of make sure you add that in last. So we got a simple syrup here, which is just sugar and water.
50-50, right?
50-50. And,
yep,
and you can use other syrups and other sweeteners.
Yep.
I've been in a bind before. I've used strawberry jam, right?
My go-to is agave when I don't have some yep, simple syrup.
Yep, exactly. Agave is fantastic.
Although they're all different sort of sweetness levels, so you have to adjust, right?
You do, yeah. You kind of, you know, especially pick and choose what you're using for what. So what we're going to be doing here is putting in our simple syrup first, and I'm just going to be doing a simple ratio of one part sweet, one part sour, and two parts spirit. Yep. And you can use that for almost any cocktail. So I'm going to be doing one part here of simple syrup. So I'm just pouring that in my measure, pouring that right on into the shaker tin there. Mm-hmm. And then I'm going to be grabbing fresh lime juice, incredibly important. Now you can, of course, the traditional gimlet was a lime cordial. My recommendation is always use your fresh lime juice. It's going to make a difference. So I'm pouring as well 1 ounce of fresh lime juice right on into that shaker tin as well. So mm-hmm. now I've got my sweet, I've got my sour, and now finally that gin component. So again, signature gin, London dry style. We're going to be pouring 2 ounces of London dry style gin. That's our signature gin right into the shaker tin. And then we're going to be shaking that up. So when it comes to shaking a cocktail, you always want to make sure it's almost a dance or a ballet when you're doing it. So I'm just going to grab a little bit of ice here. All right, perfect. So I've got both parts, and now I'm going to shake that. So you want to make sure you shake that for about, I would say, 20 to 30 seconds. Not much longer than that, but you want to make sure that you really do kind of get that full kind of extraction of the ice.
Yep.
And that it kind of blends all those ingredients properly together.
It's the agitation, and I can hear you're using smaller ice cubes, more surface area, correct?
Exactly, exactly. So that's kind of what I've gotten here. All right, perfect. So once you kind of open this up here, you're going to make sure you, there we go. Perfect. Then I'm going to want to strain that right into, what we've got here are actually our coupe glasses, but you can get more specific gimlet glassware as well.
Yep.
But this one certainly allows for a little bit of a elevated cocktail to kind of come to life. And again, a bedrock style, so it's got that sweetness, it's got that sour, and it's got the spirit as well. And I'm just going to throw a little dehydrated lime on here. As a little garnish to kind of elevate that cocktail, just like that.
So one of the benefits of hosting a talk show is you get to drink the drinks, right?
That is exactly it. And there you go.
Cheers.
Yeah, cheers. Enjoy.
Oh, delicious. Very floral. Very fresh.
Yeah. Kind of balanced.
Very cold. Only 30 seconds of shaking with ice and ice cold. Fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. I must say this is a first for myself, being able to shake a cocktail in a radio show. So,
well, there you go.
I appreciate you allowing me that opportunity.
So what's it like distilling in Canada?
Yeah, that's a great question because I don't think a lot of people are talking about it. You know, I like to kind of mention there's, I think, 57 breweries in the city of Toronto right now.
Right.
There's 4 distilleries. There's a reason for that. It's really hard. Really hard to get your licenses. It's really hard to kind of compete in the space. Fortunately, the brewing and the wine industry have had years of lobbying and support. And the distilling community isn't quite there. There's a lot of passionate distillers in Ontario and Canada. And we all kind of know each other and we all kind of help each other out. But it is just kind of the reality that the landscape is tough to navigate. But we're pretty proud to have been a part of it and still get the support from the local community. That's one of the most important things you could ask for.
Where is your distillery?
So we're located in Leslieville in Toronto, just on the east end of the city. And we've got a distillery there where we do cocktail classes and tours, where you could find out a lot more about the history of gin and things like that as well. And then we do jazz nights there as well. We host a whole range of different artists, high tea on Sundays.
I think
it's fun. We try and make sure there's always something different happening.
In order to run a distillery, do you have to be zoned in a certain area to do it? I would imagine you can't do storefront. Like you're not going to be on Yonge Street, right?
No, exactly. And then, you know, that's a part of our learning experience. You do have to be zoned industrial, and that means you're going to be located kind of, you know, south by the cement factories by the lakeshore or up in the Junction area. Those are your two primary areas. So,
yeah. Fantastic. And do you have any new products that are coming out?
Yeah, so I think we're right now heavily supporting our gin and tonic that launched in the LCBO and it's been doing very well. And so we want to make sure to continue to support that and be not just Toronto's gin. We want to be, you know, Ontario's gin and tonic. That's our passion. But next up in terms of product lineup, we have a couple different ready-to-drink cocktails that we're working on as well.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you very much for having me.
That was Graham Reed. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss cannabis and a spiritual practice on the tonic.
At Pure Encapsulations, good starts with uncompromising standards. This is why we avoid additives such as magnesium stearate. Although we know it could speed up production time, we also know it doesn't add any health benefits. Instead, time is our additive. To maintain the integrity of the premium ingredients that do benefit your health. But our commitment to wellness doesn't end there. It extends to our planet as well. Through our sustainability initiatives, we are making strides toward a healthier future.
Does your skin need some pampering? Treat yourself to a luxurious exotic oil from New Roots Herbal, organic or wildcrafted. These oils are sourced from around the globe and tested to ensure purity. Never diluted, they're rich in vitamins and nutrients for radiant, healthy-looking skin. Choose from a wide variety including argan, rosehip, or skin lover's blend. Now available in a stunning gift set, perfect for that special someone. Available only at fine health food stores.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Will Johnson is the director of the Institute for Embodiment Training, a teaching school in Costa Rica that views the body as a doorway, not the obstacle, to real spiritual growth and transformation. The author of several books, including Breathing Through the Whole Body, The Spiritual Practice of Rumi, and Eyes Wide Open, he teaches a deeply body-oriented approach to sitting meditation at Buddhist centers around the world. Welcome to the show, Will. How are you?
I'm really good. Thank you for having me here.
So what inspired you to explore the intersection of cannabis and spirituality?
Well, it really goes back to, frankly, my early years. I was probably 19 years old. This is 1966, when cannabis first comes into my life. And that was a moment, all I can describe it, it was like God's medicine for me. It showed me that there was so much more to who I am. The depth of what human being is, then this persona that I assume myself to be. What else it did, Jamie, was very interesting. Very early on, I became very clear. I had an experience what real religion, what real religious striving, if you want to call it that, is all about. It's about going inside. It's about examining what's inside human being, inside human mind, and inside human body. And over the years for me, cannabis has definitely been an ally in, the pursuit of that goal.
So a lot of people use cannabis recreationally. In your view, how can cannabis be used responsibly and in a mindful way within a spiritual context?
Yeah, it's a very good question. What I'm doing with the introduction of cannabis into sitting meditation practices is insisting, well, we have to have protocols. And one of them is you can only use a very small amount. The practices that we do that are about awakening the body, about liberating the breath, for these kinds of practices, cannabis can be an ally for many people. It's simply been over the years, I've had to admit that this is so. The whole teachings of meditation are coming from Asia over into Western cultures. Every time they've migrated, they've changed because they've interacted with the primary psychological needs, issues, just the realities. I look back on my life. I'm almost 80 years old now. And during that time, I look to, the advent and availability of things like cannabis and some of the stronger entheogens. They've been extraordinary introductions into a culture that have given people experiences of awakening. And I think we would be remiss as explorers of what it is to be a human being to turn our back on this. So it's coming over into Western culture. There's the use of substances like cannabis for spiritual awakening. That's my particular focus as a meditation teacher. And, what also we have, and it really relates to cannabis, the other thing that has been primary in my life, it's people are starting to move. When I was a young kid, my body wasn't moving to music, to dances, the way, our young people, the young at heart people are. And the two of these go very much together. So I teach a very, very body-oriented form of sitting practice that cannabis really supports.
I find when I use cannabis recreationally, it has a number of sort of effects on me that I wonder how they intersect with a meditation practice. So for one, my sense of time gets completely changed. Time seems to slow down for me. The positive aspect for me is also I have a mind that is very busy. A lot of voices in my head, a lot of things, a lot of thoughts race through my mind. But I find I call it turning my brain off when I take cannabis, and I'm able to just sort of experience things a little bit differently. And I'm wondering if that plays into what you're talking about, using it in a spiritual context.
Well, it completely plays into what I'm talking about. And actually, what you just said is sort of an expression of awakening, for lack of a better word, spirituality. We can turn down the, I call it the ticker tape parade of thoughts in the mind. It just goes on and on. And then what we also do, we awaken what I call the felt shimmer of the body. And cannabis really supports that. And when you awaken the felt shimmer of the body, time shifts. Because what happens, you can only experience bodily presence in this moment. So we kind of move out of a time-oriented thought, conceptual being, into a very present and awakened experience being. So yeah, it works very, very closely that way.
Okay, let's explore some of the misconceptions about using cannabis in spiritual practice. What sort of issues come up, or what do you hear?
Okay, well, the main one is in the traditional Buddhist precepts. The fifth precept is we're not going to use mind-altering substances. And most teachers from Asia, they were born into that context, and they feel very, very strongly about that. Now, it's very interesting. Some of the Asian teachers who've never used any of these substances think they're very bad. Many of us who are coming up in the West, who've been exploring, I've been exploring sitting practices for over 50 years now. We have a different perspective and more openness to, well, really explore what are the homegrown spiritual awakening events that have occurred in our culture. But, you know, that's the main one. My understanding also, originally in the very, very ancient Buddhist world, the precept against mind-altering substances, it was against alcohol. I have no idea. I'm not a scholar how much cannabis was used in those days, but there are authors and books that are coming out now showing things like cannabis, things like different entheogenic substances that were certainly instrumental in the awakening of the Vedic understanding coming down into India, and also into some very early Buddhist practices. So in a sense, we're just remaining open to what works.
How do you see cannabis as enhancing a spiritual experience beyond what we just discussed about sort of like, you know, altering of time and sort of shutting out the noise?
Yeah, and that too is an interesting question. Now, for traditional practices that are coming over from Asia that are largely what we would call mentally focused, I'm focusing my attention on my nostrils. I'm experiencing breath move in and out. I'm being very mindfully aware. These substances don't work that well. But the shift that is happening here in North America and Europe, throughout the world, the practice is changing from a mind-oriented focus to a body awakening focus. Okay? Mm-hmm. So for the purpose of what I call awakening the shimmer. What am I getting at there? On every part of the body, down to the smallest little cell, probably smaller than that, we can feel these little pinprick blips of sensation. They're vibrating, almost imaginably rapid rates of vibratory frequency, but we can still feel them. When I am lost in my mind, lost in thought, I put a blanketing shroud over this whole field of tactile vibratory awakening. And cannabis helps make that shift, kind of pulling the plug on the lost in thought consciousness, and hence what just starts appearing altogether naturally is, well, an awareness. It's not just awareness, it's a felt experience of body as palpable vibratory field. And so look, we have vision, we can see, we have sounds, we can hear. In the world of sensory tactility, there's this shimmering presence that could be present in a very deeply awakened, deeply relaxed body. But again, the lost in thought consciousness shuts that down. So in a sense, we're awakening this primary pillar of human experience, and awakening experience is what spirituality is all about.
We have time for one last question, and that is, if you had one piece of advice to offer somebody who's considering incorporating cannabis into their spiritual practice for their first time, what would that be?
You know, the advice would probably be, sit down, take cannabis, sit, play with upright balancing. Cannabis allows you to come awake. Just as you're sitting there, just start becoming aware of what starts happening. You may want to pass your awareness through your body, inviting sensation to awaken. The cannabis is going to support that. As soon as sensation awakens anywhere in the body, then meet it with a gesture of relaxation. Cannabis is a deeply body-oriented, breath-liberating approach to spiritual awakening. Over time, all sorts of things just start to shift. More sensations appear, breath changes. The only thing you need to do is accept whatever happens and then let go. It's interesting, Jamie. Sometimes people ask me what the strongest thing that I do in my teaching, and what I really have to tell people is that I give people permission to let go. To let this strong awakening occur. There's a current that comes with it. Just let go. This is human. Nothing could be more human.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I really enjoyed being with you here, Jamie. Thank you.
That was Will Johnson. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how to boost your vagus nerve function on The Tonic. Tired of lineups at your pharmacist? Why not try Pharma-Z at the Zoomer Store? Powered by the Health Depot, an Ontario-accredited pharmacy, Pharma-Z offers a concierge approach to filling, refilling, and managing your prescriptions with free delivery anywhere in Ontario. To get started, visit ZoomerStore.com and click on Pharma-Z. And then click on the Circle of Care Pharmacy program for your free initial consultation with a clinical pharmacist. Don't wait. Go today. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000 square foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha, visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Nawaz Habib, DC, is the best-selling author of Activate Your Vagus Nerve, which is a Ulysses Press book from 2022, and Upgrade Your Vagus Nerve, another Ulysses Press book from 2024. He's the founder of Health Upgraded, an online functional health consulting clinic, which supports optimal health by elevating the awareness and function of the vagus nerve. And he's the host of the Health Upgrade podcast. After graduating as class valedictorian from the Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College in 2010, he went on to practice traditional chiropractic for years until he utilized the power of functional medicine to transform his own health. He continued his lifelong journey to seek answers about everything vagus nerve related at the Institute of Functional Medicine, and you can find him online at drnawazhabib.com, and you can follow him at Dr. Nawaz Habib on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn. Welcome to the show. How are you?
I am well. Thanks for having me.
So we have covered the vagus nerve before, but for those who haven't heard those amazing interviews, what is the vagus nerve?
The vagus nerve is the single point of connection between the brain and essentially every organ in the body that signals to the cells in those organs, whether to be in a state of preparation and ready to react with inflammation or to shut down the inflammation. And so it's the connecting point, and we say the vagus nerve, but really there's two, one on each side of the body. These nerves come together and they send important signals between the visceral organs that are in the abdomen and within the chest up to the brain and back down. And so it's really important that we have great function of this particular nerve, because the signals that are passed here can't get passed through any other area of the body or any other nerve.
So which symptoms are actually controlled through the vagus nerves?
The vagus nerve to the heart actually lowers the heart rate, so it slows down the number of beats per minute. To the lungs, it actually sends anti-inflammatory signals, so it goes to the macrophages, which are a very important immune cell there, to help lower the inflammatory reaction or inflammatory burden that's occurring. And it goes to the gut, which is really important because signals from the gut are making their way up to the brain. About 80% of the signals actually go from those organs up to the brain. But the signals that are then coming down tell the immune system cells that are present in each of those organs whether to go into a state of rest and digest and recover or to go into a state of fight or flight. And so what we often see is poor gut function or decreased detoxification through the liver or inability to digest food effectively through the stomach. There's a lot of potential triggers that can not react well when the vagus nerve is not working effectively.
Okay, so what causes the vagus nerve not to be working? Is it a matter of simply getting older, or are there other impacts?
It's definitely not an age-related issue. It's actually more of an accumulation of stress. And we need to talk about all the different types of stress that would do this. I've categorized it down into four different areas. The main ones that we think of when we think of stress would be like emotional or psychological stress. These are adverse childhood events, victim of a crime, et cetera, et cetera. Basic challenges of day-to-day life, like finances or relationships. Those are stressors that we often think of, but we can't forget the physical stressors, things like a lack of exercise or overdoing it. Been in a car accident or had a concussion. Those are physical stressors that can cause dysfunction of the vagus nerve and of many other organs as well. And then the last area is biochemical stress. And biochemical means, do we have too much toxin, negative toxin making its way into our body, or do we lack a lot of the vitamins, minerals, and nutrients that need to be present for our cells to do their job? So it's usually the accumulation of all of these stressors building up over time that leads to dysfunction of the vagus nerve. It's like we've got our foot on the gas and the brakes just aren't able to slow the car down. And the brakes would be the vagus nerve in this analogy.
So when you talk about toxins, what sort of toxins are you referring to? Would that include alcohol and drugs? Are you looking? Yeah, are you talking about environmental as well?
It's a combination of all of it. So excess alcohol consumption is going to be a big one. Medications, drugs, excess usage are going to be involved because the job of the liver and other organs is to eliminate these, and these are toxic burdens that can build up in the body. But then we've got bacterial toxin, which is far more common. We have 100 trillion bacteria present in our gut, and when there's a dysfunction or a dysbiosis type of situation where the microbiome, those bacterial populations change, then we have these toxins that can enter our body very effectively and very easily through what's called a leaky gut, and that can become a toxic burden through a biochemical stress component. So there's a lot of different toxins that can enter the body, not just what we do actively, but a lot of passive toxins make their way in as well.
Can we actually measure if our vagus nerve is operating or functioning properly?
Yeah, we absolutely can. And one of the best ways to do that is measuring a particular number called heart rate variability. And so HRV, or heart rate variability, is not a measure of number of beats per minute. That's heart rate. But heart rate variability measures the number of milliseconds between beats of the heart averaged over a period of time. And HRV is the best way to measure how resilient somebody is to these stressors. And our resilience is determined by the difference between our vagus nerve sending its anti-inflammatory parasympathetic signals and other nerves in the body known as the sympathetic nerves sending their signals to the heart. And what then happens is we have a variance or a variability of the number of milliseconds between beats of the heart. We're actually looking for a higher HRV. We want to have more variability. We don't want our heart to beat like a metronome. We want it to beat in a slightly arrhythmic pattern because that tells us that both the sympathetics and the parasympathetics are working. Both the stress, the fight or flight side is working, the gas can be pushed, and the brakes are working effectively to slow everything down. And that means the vagus nerve is working really well.
Okay, so what can we do to improve vagus nerve function?
There's a lot of really important things that we can do foundationally to help improve the function of the vagus nerves. And number one is to actually learn how to breathe effectively. Too many people are breathing really, really ineffectively. We often find that our patients that are dealing with autoimmune conditions or some sort of major health, chronic inflammatory condition, have altered or less than optimal breathing patterns. That means they're breathing with their chest rather than breathing with their diaphragmatic muscles and doing more of a belly breath. It means that they're breathing too fast and they're breathing through their mouth and they're breathing too shallow. What we want to be doing is breathing through our belly, breathing through our nose, and having very slow and calm breaths that are occurring. Most people aren't doing that on a regular basis, and so that's a foundational thing that needs to be worked on by basically everybody. But then when you get really good at breathing generally, when you're under stress, then you'd have to start to teach your body to breathe better while you are under stress. So this is where exercise can come in. This is where we can do things like humming, chanting, and gargling to not only trigger that exhale and to be really deliberate with that exhalation phase, which is important for the vagus nerve to turn on, but also create the vocalization. There are some motor components to the vagus nerve that go to the back of the throat, that go to the muscles around the vocal cords. And so when we hum, when we chant, when we gargle, we're focusing on the breath and we're focusing on activating these muscles in those areas, in the pharyngeal and laryngeal areas. So having these areas working really well, breathing really effectively, and then breathing under stress, meaning exercise and learning to breathe effectively while you're running on the treadmill or lifting weights or whatever it is that you're doing for exercise. And then one level up from that, learning to breathe really effectively while jumping into a cold shower or a cold plunge or in the sauna. Those are stressors on a temperature level that you can teach your body to handle really effectively and breathe effectively through those. So you're focused on long exhale, nasal breathing, diaphragmatic breathing, and trying to do that then while under stress, if you do well when you're not under stress to begin with.
So when you talk about exercise, are you saying that, like, you know, training your body to be more efficient simply by doing exercise, or are you talking specifically about sort of mindfulness exercises that would impact the way that you breathe, or maybe it's both?
I think it's both, actually. So the way we breathe, the mindfulness work that we do is really important. And so I call those mindfulness practices, but yes, you're exactly right. They are exercises as well. So in that sense, when we're talking mindfulness, 100%, we want to put a lot of attention to the awareness of what our body is doing, both when we're under stress and when we're not, and learning how to control those patterns really effectively. And then when we are physically exercising, when we're on the treadmill, when we're lifting weights, when we're on our bikes, whatever it is, or swimming, we want to learn to have nasal breathing occurring, diaphragmatic, deliberate, slow breath occurring while under these physically demanding moments.
Time for one last question, and that is, if somebody's really suffering, if somebody, their vagus nerve is not operating properly, is there one top tip that you have or one thing that you would suggest foremost to deal with that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. The thing that I'm the biggest fan of is the use of vagus nerve stimulation. And that is literally the electrical stimulation of areas around where the vagus nerve can be found in the body. And the main area is in the neck near where you find your pulse, literally within a few millimeters of where your carotid artery is on either side of your neck. We've got the physical trunk of the vagus nerve, and electrical stimulation of the vagus nerve is the thing that I'm the biggest fan of when it comes to helping people get out of a chronic, challenging, inflammatory situation, and pairing that with the breath exercises that we talked about earlier.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It's my absolute pleasure.
That was Dr. Navaz Habib. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the connection between menopause and alcohol on The Tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to local, organic, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since 1983.
They're a one-stop shop offering produce, grocery, bulk, body care, and holistic dispensary. The juice and smoothie bars and kitchens serve up hundreds of healthy dishes and drinks daily. Building community is at the core of their vision, which they deliver through education, outreach, and giving. They want everyone to share in the goodness they offer. Visit their website for more information at thebigcarrot.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Sophie Solmini, the founder of Heal at Home, is on a mission to change how we approach addiction. Inspired by her own family tragedy, she started Heal at Home in 2016 to help people struggling with alcohol use disorder, AUD, with certifications including internationally certified alcohol and drug counselor, medication-assisted treatment specialist, and nationally certified recovery coach. Her commitment to changing lives shines through everything she does. Welcome to the show, Sophie. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm well. So today we're going to talk about the nexus between menopause and alcoholism. How does alcohol consumption affect women differently from men, particularly as they approach menopause?
Oh, so there's a big difference. Think of it like this. So the woman's body generally processes alcohol differently than men, because women have more fat than men and less water. So generally speaking, it's already a big difference between men and women. But when menopause comes around, this difference becomes more pronounced. It's like our body becomes more sensitive to alcohol. So women would feel it more strongly than it was before the menopause.
Okay. Are there specific risks associated with drinking alcohol during menopause transition?
Yes. So again, because there are so many changes, so women start to experience, maybe you have heard about it, like hot flashes, night sweats, sleeping problem, and all of this could be could get worse if you add alcohol in the mix. So it's never a good time to start or even to continue drinking alcohol during that period.
So we're talking about perimenopause, right? When
yes,
that, like, menopause, by menopause the symptomology has already occurred. It's during perimenopause that women have the hot flashes and have sort of the hormonal changes, right? That's really the issue, isn't it?
You know, everybody is different. So there's lots. It's so different for so many people. And when you think about perimenopause, it could last up to 10 years, this perimenopause. So even women don't really know which stage they are. That being said, some women would have no symptoms, but some others, menopause, which happened after perimenopause, for some women, they will still have hot flash, night sweat all along. So it's really different for every single woman. Nevertheless, if you are in perimenopause, menopause, or postmenopause, you will always have some kind of imbalance and some trouble with your hormones change.
So let's stick with the topic of hormonal changes. Do those hormonal changes impact a woman's ability to metabolize alcohol?
It's not that it affects the metabolization, because it's already the case before. Because, as I said, women are different, are different than men. So it always affects. It's not so much that the hormones, I don't really know how to explain this, because really it's more on the medical side. And
okay,
this is not really what I would be comfortable, because again, everybody is different.
Okay, so do the hormone levels during perimenopause or menopause influence tolerance or the effects of alcohol in women?
Yes, so because the hormone levels goes up and down during menopause, the tolerance to alcohol can really dip. This means that the amount of alcohol that didn't bother us much like before now has a stronger effect. It's really That's why it could be really surprising for some women that they come and they said, I used to have 2 glasses of wine at night, and now to get the same effect, like I have those 2 glasses of wine who were not impacting me as much, now totally knock me off. And they don't understand what's happening. And it's totally connected with the hormones level.
But, okay, so men and women change as they get older, right? I mean, you know, this is a bad analogy, but it's an analogy. Like, I used to be able to eat many pieces of pepperoni pizza when I was younger. But now I find if I eat pepperoni pizza, I can only have a few pieces before it's too salty and I'm up all night. And you know, similarly with alcohol, like I'm not going through perimenopause, but I can't drink as much alcohol as I used to. I mean, don't people sort of get these cues from their body so that they know something's going on, whether they understand it's menopause or perimenopause or not? I mean, we all kind of notice these changes in our bodies, don't we?
Yes, we do. And interestingly, men as well go through some phases of change.
True.
I don't remember the name, but it's something similar to menopause.
Andropause. Andropause, yes, is the term.
Yeah. Exactly. So, yes, men will go through the same thing. So, yes, in that case. What it makes it different for women,
yep,
is that the consequences for the body are more important due to those changes of hormones. And it could really lead to severe consequences. So it's not so much about, okay, I have 2 glasses and now I cannot have any more. It's like, oh, my God, now I start to have some impact on my health, like heart disease. You know, we recently find out that women who drinks more than 1 drink per day, which is not a lot, okay? So for a maximum of 8 per week,
yep,
have 50% more chance than another woman to develop a heart condition.
I read that study. And we actually mentioned that on the show that aired either last week or the week before. I'm aware of that study. So, yes,
okay.
You're absolutely right. Alcohol and women. But in that particular study, the issue was primarily focused on binge drinking, where a woman was drinking, I think more than 2 or 3 glasses of alcohol per day. But, yes, I am familiar with that study. Let's circle back to alcohol and menopausal symptoms like hot flashes and sleep disturbances and mood changes. How does alcohol potentially impact that?
So again, you know, when you have those mood changes that no one really talked about, because the perimenopause, menopause is a new topic that some people start to talk about, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So some women arrive to a certain age, they didn't notice the changes, okay? Because we are running, we have the kids, and we are always busy. Suddenly, you start to feel like some kind of different feelings that you do not associate directly to menopause at the beginning. And then you start to cope with those feelings. And women who were drinking before, and we're not talking about women who had AUD, okay, or alcohol use disorder, regular women who were coping with those changes by drinking alcohol, and they were saying, okay, now I have those night sweats, or I have difficulty to fall asleep. They add alcohol because they think it might help,
right,
dealing with this, you know, and it makes it even worse without you realizing that this is not the best coping mechanism.
Right. Okay. So how can women manage alcohol consumption to support their health and well-being during menopause? What should they do?
One word: moderation. Always trying to make sure to stay below the safety guidelines, which are, as you may know, no more than 2 drinks per week. By staying under those guidelines, you have good chance to avoid health consequences. So really, it's always to strategize. And if you drink alcohol, always have something non-alcoholic after 1 alcoholic drink. You know, always trying to make sure you control how much you are putting into your body. And also trying to find alternative way to relax or unwind, you know, like exercise, spending time with loved ones, going out, walking the dog, you know, and maybe also talk with your physician to see if those symptoms that you have needs to be treated in another way than with alcohol.
Good advice.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Graham Reed, Will Johnson, Naviz Habib, and Sophie Solmini. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.